it that you're terribly impressed as I am with the reading, and you give me a moment to get hooked up here, because to tell you the truth, beloved, this is the first time that I've ever preached in a roundhouse. And I would like to say that you made the roundhouse ring with the singing. I realize the importance of music and would commend every minister of music here, because here's one pastor who recognizes the tremendous contribution that you make to the life of our churches. I heard about one little girl who was more impressed with the singing on Sunday than she was with what the preacher had to say. So on Monday, after the other children had gone to school, she was there with her mother. She was about 3 years old, and they were out in the kitchen doing the dishes. And they had worked for some time, and the little girl had enjoyed the music in the service the day before so much that she said to her mother, "Now, Mother, I want us to sing the songs that we used in the service yesterday." And the mother said, "All right, dear, I'll be happy to sing with you." And they went through the songs about three or four times there as they completed the work to be done in the kitchen. And after they had been singing about an hour, the mother said, "Now, darling, I've enjoyed singing with you very, very much, but I'm just exhausted and we have a lot of work to do. And we just can't sing anymore." So the little girl looked back at her mother and she said, "All right, Mother, we'll sing one more verse, and if no one comes, our service will be over." I'm sure that Paul must have squinted his eyes, because the light was not good in the Mamertine prison, to read again the words that he'd written to his young friend, his son in the ministry, Timothy. "I charge thee therefore before God and the Lord Jesus Christ, who shall judge the quick and the dead at his appearing and his kingdom, preach the word, be instant in season, out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine." And I think, my friend, if you would let me summarize what Paul said to young Timothy in about 10 words, it was this: Timothy, you are to be God's man in every season. You are to be his agent for change in a world that desperately needs changing. Perhaps Paul would have put it a little bit differently as he penned the correspondence to the congregation at Romans. You remember I said, "I beseech you therefore, brethren, do not be conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God." And you've read the translation of this same verse in Phillips' translation. For Dr. Phillips said what Paul was saying was this: don't let the world squeeze you into its mold. God's man is to be an agent for change. He's to do the squeezing. He is to make the mold. In many ways, we need to change this world in which we live today. And the man of God can never be satisfied to sit by passively and let the world change him. You be my agent for change. The man of God should be God's agent for change. As in a season of religious convenience, he stands by his religious conviction. This was a problem in Ephesus. Paul was in Ephesus. It was not that the Ephesians were saying we have no use for religion in our life. It was that they were saying we want to make this thing called Christianity a matter of convenience and not a matter of conviction. And I thank God that Timothy was one preacher who was not willing to succumb to the pressure. I thank God that he remained a man who stood by his convictions. It's possible that he might have led the association in additions if he had lowered the standards just a bit. It's even possible that he might have had more additions than anyone in the state if he had lowered his standards just a bit. If he had made religion a matter of convenience instead of convictions, but he refused to do it. God's man is to be an agent of change, to bring the standard up, that religion might become a matter of conviction again. I ask you, my preacher friend, would you say that we have a convenient religion in this day and age in which we live. I ask you, how many of us, 11 million Southern Baptists, how many of us know anything about a religion of conviction? Is it not largely a matter of convenience? I'd hate to have the job of finding 11 million Southern Baptists. Beloved, all the FBI men in the United States, plus all the Canadian Mounted Police in Canada, plus all the people in Scotland Yard in England, could not find 11 million Southern Baptists if their lives depended upon it. We can't find them. And the gospel truth is that from one-third to one-half of the people on the rolls of our church are a positive hindrance to the work of God, because we have made religion a matter of convenience and not conviction. Now, you may call this heresy, but in our church we've started something different. And we have people coming down the aisle asking for membership in the church. We ask these people to become involved in three sessions as we think together about what it means to be a Christian and a church member. Now, we've had some people come to say, look, I'm not willing to be involved in any three seminar studies as you think together about what it means to be a Christian and what this church is trying to do for God and what the Bible teaches. I'm not interested in that. A lady told me the other day, she had marched down the aisle seeking membership, and she told us quite frankly, now I'm not interested in all of this stuff about attending and studying and working. I just want to be a member. And I said, well, ma'am, sorry about that. Sorry about that, ma'am. But we're through making members, and from now on, God being our helper, we're going to make disciples. And there's a lot of difference. There's a lot of difference. I have sort of a Gideon complex now. I watch people come close and then shy away. I've seen some that would have gladly joined, and they've decided, well, I don't want to be a part of that fellowship. You have to get involved. And I've got a Gideon complex. I've seen some of them go and join other churches. But you know, beloved, we're having more people attend than we've had in a long time, and more people being saved, and more people giving more money to the causes of Jesus Christ, because we're saying there's a difference between being religious because it's convenient and because of a conviction. I say that in this time, when religion has become largely a matter of convenience, God's minister must be an agent of change. Well, look again. The man of God should change this pessimistic attitude in which we live from one of pessimism to one of optimism. The Apostle Paul might have been the most discouraged man in all the world. The cause that he had given his life for was suffering by persecution in the West and by apostasy in the East. He might have been the most discouraged man in the world because he was all alone and his friends were long gone, and he knew that in a matter of days he would be executed. But as you read this last letter penned by the Apostle Paul prior to the time of his death, I challenge you to find one word in there that is pessimistic. The Apostle Paul was the world's second greatest optimist. The greatest optimist in this world, believe it or not, my friend, is not Norman Vincent Peale, but Jesus Christ. For he said, be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. My friend, we're losing a lot of preachers today because they've been slain by the giant called the giant despair. They're so depressed, so depressed. A few weeks ago, we had Frank Broyles speak in our church. Now, I should say that I am from Arkansas, first of all, and Frank Broyles is a coach at the University of Arkansas. He's not a Baptist, but brother, he's a great Christian. Oh, he's a great Christian. Not like Frank Beard. I read about Frank Beard the other day on a golf tournament, and he wanted to win so bad. He said, "Lord, if you let me win this tournament," first prize money was $50,000. He said, "Lord, if you let me win this tournament, I'll give $5,000 to charity." I'm going to write Frank and say, "Frank, who'd you give it to?" He won. Well, Frank Broyles is a tither and a great Christian. Well, how many of you folks saw that football game between Texas and Arkansas? You've got some Texans here. I hear you. Now, beloved, that was the greatest football game ever played in America. Can you imagine the setting, a more dramatic hour? The President of the United States of America and Billy Graham and all these thousands of people and a congregation, excuse me, what would you call that? An audience of millions and millions across the nation. What a tragedy! What a tragedy! Arkansas lost. I want to tell you something, beloved. It was only fitting that Texas pray the Lord's Prayer after that game, because they did not walk through the valley of the shadow of death. They spent the afternoon there. There's one man who has not looked at those game films as of yet, and that's Frank Broyles. He told me this. The game was played 6 months ago, and he cannot bring himself to look at the films. I'll tell you one guy that's looked at him. That Darrell Royal has worn the reel out looking at him. Yes, sir. Now, do you think that Darrell Royal breaks out in a sweat when Texas fumbles the ball in the first quarter down there on their goal line and Arkansas scores? I tell you, beloved, he doesn't break out in a cold sweat. Do you think he breaks out in a rash when Arkansas scores again? I say not so. Does he begin to shake with fright and fear when they score again and the thing is hopelessly out of reach for the Longhorns? Well, not on your life. You see, he knows how the game comes out. No question about that. Some of us are so discouraged and so despondent because as God's men, it seems like we're behind 32 to nothing and there's 1 minute left in the game. But I want to tell you, preacher friend, you've forgotten this. You're going to win! There's no question about that. I don't care what happens, you're on the winning side. And the last chapter in this book is not one of defeat, but one of victory. The kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and of His Christ. And He shall reign forever and ever and ever. Now you remember that. You remember that. In a season when you get so discouraged that the number one thing you're concerned about doing here at Denver is seeing at least 25 preachers and telling them, "Well, things are great in my church, but if you could help me to move, oh, if you could just help me to move." Now, brother, you remember how this thing's going to come out. God's man should be optimistic, even in this pessimistic day and age in which we live. we are to make the necessary changes. And if we are God's men, then He's given us the power and the wherewithal to be used in bringing these changes about. Do not let the world squeeze you into its mold, but make the mold, and by God's grace, let's squeeze the world to fit that pattern of Jesus Christ, the Son of God.